I'm very pleased to welcome back to View from the Roundhouse Professor Martin Drum from Notre Dame University in Fremantle, or is it somewhere else today, Martin?
In the West, certainly at the moment, Michael. So not travelling at the moment. It's a beautiful time to be in Perth and enjoying the beaches as well.
Well, it's sailing, sailing, sailing all around Fremantle, Martin. It's not so much sailing. Maybe there's a little bit near Davos. I suspect that they're doing a little more downhill skiing. Cross country would be a good idea. It might be more soothing. But look, we'll get to the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, soon enough. And Prime Minister Carney's epochal speech there, and Trump's, and Greenland, and Ukraine. The Gaza board will even get to that. And my proposal for a neutral Australia that withdraws from ANZUS and AUKUS, Martin, in favour of joining a middle powers bloc. But can I first ask you this? Is Trump, or perhaps more precisely Trumpism, responsible for the coalition's latest split? What's the background to it all? What's your take? What happens next?
So this split between the Liberal and National parties this week is one of the most extraordinary developments, and it's almost come out of the blue to many observers, Michael, because the pressure was really on the Prime Minister. Then all of a sudden, during this bills discussion, etc., the coalition split badly on it, and they're a mess, and all the focus is on them. But I think there is an underlying element to it, as you've hinted at. I describe it as populism, Michael. Just the reality that the populist right in many Western countries like ours has been on the march. And in the UK, Reform Party is outpolling the Conservatives and Labour. And for the first time ever, One Nation is outpolling the Coalition in primary vote. And that's an extraordinary development. Now, that's not saying necessarily that that will happen, that they will perform that well at the next election, but it certainly sent shivers down National's spine. And to give you some context, Michael, where's that 21-22% that the One Nation might be getting? It's coming from regional areas. It's coming from the seats that the Nationals hold, not entirely, but predominantly. So they're really spooked by that. They want to free themselves up to probably pursue some of the policies One Nation pursues. And that's what this is all about. It's not really about one particular bill. I think that this is on the cards for that reason.
Well, as you say, our Prime Minister Albanese was suffering in the polls quite significantly. His approval rating had sort of plummeted after the government's response to the Bondi terror tragedy the 14th of December last. And he's been racing to catch up ever since. He's called the Royal Commission. He rushed legislation into Parliament. And then there was response. And that seems to be the specific reason for the split in the coalition ranks, Martin.
Yeah, I think the irony of all this is it was Suzanne Ley that was calling for Parliament to be recalled as soon as possible to develop hate speech laws to put the quote the hate preachers out of business. That was pressure being put on from the coalition, and when this actually eventuated, divisions in their own ranks became the main issue. So it's been quite extraordinary how this has actually developed. And you've got sort of the more libertarian types who fear that it's going to encroach upon free speech, and then there are others that are concerned about anti-Semitism and the like that see these laws as very necessary. But it's been an awful mess for them.
But after the last election, we had these contretemps between the Nationals and the Liberals, didn't we, before they decided to get back together again. It does seem to be, as you're suggesting, that the Nationals want to mark their brand out as specifically out in the bush. They don't want to be tainted with any of this teal type stuff that's happening in the Australian cities.
Yeah, I think that's what this is about. There's two options that will happen now, both of which will suit the Nationals. Either the Liberals continue under Suzanne Ley's leadership, which I think is increasingly unlikely, actually, and they get to rebrand themselves, particularly focusing on the bush, and they'll pursue more conservative policy settings. Or, and I think this is more likely, the Libs will ditch Ley and go with someone from the right faction, which is either Angus Taylor or Andrew Hastie, probably, and they will move to the right themselves. And that will suit the Nationals as well because their policy settings will align a little bit better. So it's a bit of a win-win for them in the short term.
And if that were to happen, I suppose they'd all climb back into the political bed and make up close to the next election, Martin.
I think that I mean, if you listen to Little Proud, he's firmly put the heat on Suzanne Ley's leadership. He said, just said under they can't continue to work together under Suzanne Ley's leadership. So he's opening the door for a leadership change and perhaps for them to get back together.
I suppose he has to sound tough because there's a lot of commentators suggesting he'll have to fall on his sword as well, or on somebody's sword.
Yeah, this is the problem he's facing is with his One Nation surge and the departure of Barnaby Joyce, for instance. The Nationals themselves are under a lot of pressure, and a lot of their own MPs have been complaining they haven't got things right. You've got people like Matt Canavan that's got no time for Little Proud and would like to challenge him, and he's not alone.
Well, the elephant in the room, you mentioned it at the outset, but we need to come back to it, is One Nation. Pauline Hanson has promoted herself as a PM in waiting, Martin. Do you think she'll suggest, or the Nationals will suggest, that they merge and become a major force in right-wing conservative politics in the country?
That would be a pretty extraordinary step. Interesting suggestion. I think that the people in the Nationals, given they've had such a long history, would be loath to do that. And some of them still have very low opinions of Pauline Hanson. I mean, they claim, if you speak to them, that people like Ron Boswell, if you go back far enough, Michael, for us political historians, they claim that they saw Hanson off in the late 90s and they can do so again. It's a tougher ask now because I think the whole international political scene with so much uncertainty has led people to think of their own countries first and foremost, and then aligned with that to focus on immigration and those sorts of issues. So, it's actually good political environment for a party like One Nation at the moment.
And how do you think Albanese's Labor government will adjust, respond, adapt to all of this?
Oh, well, I mean, I think it's a huge short-term boon for him because he was under a lot of pressure at the very end of last year and start of this year. And suddenly the spotlight's on the coalition. But I think you want to be a bit careful because he'll have to have the right arguments in place and the right policy settings in place to combat a full-blown campaign on immigration because I think sometimes anti-immigration sentiments are quite strong. And so I think that that's something that he'll be thinking ahead, I would imagine, and looking at what they can do now.
Martin, I had been playing around with an idea that's always been in the back of my mind about Australia's place in the world. I'm an old time born in 1950 watcher of Australian politics, always wanted us to look to Asia and not just think of ourselves as a European outpost in an Asian context. Always attracted by the way Paul Keating went about things, and before that, even Gough Whitlam, who went off to China and wasn't so frightened about it. But lately, I've been thinking after Trumpism's impact on the world that perhaps Australia needed to become neutral, like Switzerland or Austria and a few countries around the place. I think even Ireland might have a bit of a claim to that. And then lo and behold, Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney came out with this, what I'm calling an epochal speech at the World Economic Forum the other day. And you read through it, it's a powerful piece. It sort of said everything that I felt and thought. What do you make of it?
I think it was a really strong speech. It was really interesting because Canada has some of the same complications that Australia has in terms of our relationship with the US. And in many ways, they're far more intertwined. They do everything with the US. Even their sporting competitions are interlocked and the like. But there's clearly in Canada a strong sentiment that they've been taken for granted for too long. And Trump in particular has made Canada bashing a bit of an art form. But there are other things that are in that speech that are really important too. He talked about how middle powers can be more agile and flexible and think about their own interests, but also the broader interests of the international community more effectively as well. So I thought given that Australia and Canada both are at similar countries and both middle powers, so to speak, and for non-international relations, Michael, that means someone who's neither a superpower and dominates world politics, but is neither totally inconsequential either, but as part of coalitions and groupings, can seek to influence political debate internationally. So I think that there was a lot in that speech that was quite interesting.
Well, he just finished and sort of going out the door when President Trump turned up in Davos, sort of waved to him and told Mark Carney to sort of watch himself as he left left the scene. And then Trump spoke. Now, an extraordinary speech in so many ways, and the fact checkers had a lot of fun. What did you make of it?
Oh, look, it was quite astonishing. Firstly, he's walked back some of his rhetoric on taking Greenland by force, at least. And that appears to be after speaking to the Secretary General of NATO. Well, but NATO is the fascinating point here. He openly bashed NATO. Now, NATO is the predominant military alliance in the world, and it's headed by the US. And it's been one consistent global reality for 50, 60, 70 years. And so to hear the president of America bash NATO like that, and certainly some of those European countries are outraged by what he said, particularly how he criticized them in Afghanistan and said, well, they came along, but they're a little bit further behind. A lot of NATO troops lost their lives. You know, I think the Brits lost 450 odd people alone. A lot of other countries lost their lives. Including Danes, Michael, who are in this Greenland stoush. So I think there's a lot of consternation and outrage in Europe. We know that Trump sort of has a bit of a dim view of Europe and how it's gone to seed and all of that anyway, Michael, but he was probably more brazen and out in the open in attacking them this time.
Amazing, isn't it? It'd be a bit like dismissing Australia's involvement in Vietnam because we didn't have as many troops or with different rifles or something like that. It's really quite appalling behaviour, which really makes you wonder about having someone who's 78 years effectively trying to run world affairs. And I don't think he is. I think it's the aiders and abettors behind him who are really important in all of this, Martin. And they include his mate. Steve is rushing off to meet with Putin again to talk about Ukraine. There's sort of some strange reason to think that something might happen.
Well, I mean, we all want to see peace in Ukraine. I think that's a worthy goal. Firstly, it appears to be elusive every time it gets close. It doesn't actually happen. But generally speaking, what people have discussed, we haven't seen the exact deals being proposed, but it seems that there's a fair bit of territory being conceded by Ukraine as part of any of these deals, and a recognition of Russian sovereignty over those areas. So that will enrage Europe further. So, this sort of backing out of NATO, sort of not quite cozying up to Russia, but having, the thing about Trump that's so complex too is there's so many parts of the argument that are different. So, his argument for taking over Greenland is to prevent the Russians and Chinese from taking its resources and from using those trade areas and from taking over it, from developing that area, taking over that area. So, there's a lot of inconsistencies there.
Well, Martin, if he's able to claim that he's pulled off something by way of peace in Ukraine, and we'll come to the Gaza board in a moment, then he'd be very upset if the Nobel Peace Committee didn't award him next year's Peace Prize. In fact, I suspect he'd start judicial review proceedings in the US Supreme Court to get it overturned. But perhaps we can just go to what's the story with the Gaza board. I wouldn't want to be on it. What about you?
Look, when this board was, I think this comes out of the 20-point peace plan. I think in principle it sounded like if it had the right membership, a potentially positive development, because you do actually need others to take from outside, a combination of inside and outside voices, to come together to try and collectively plot the future of Gaza with the voices of Palestine and And I think Israel will obviously have a say as well. They have to. Everyone has to. But the people that are currently on that board, or the people that said, yes, Michael, let's say that, are just, the people who wanted for war crimes. There are people who can't even get a visa to the US because of what they've done. I think the president of Belarus is there. And you've only got to look at his human rights record. I think most developed countries are sitting back, not committing, and waiting and seeing what happens here. I think the principle was good, but Trump and his team need to do a lot more legwork behind the scenes to ensure that the purpose of the board was clearer, and also work on major. So this is where the poor relationship with European leaders matters, Michael, because if they got along with European leaders, they could get them in on the act. They're one element of this that would be really helpful. It's not looking very promising at the moment.
Well, when I last looked, it didn't appear there was intended to be any representative of the people in Gaza, the Palestinians in Gaza, on the board. And you wonder about the traditional understanding that a lot of the invited people in their countries have in respect of either the Middle East or the Palestinians in particular. I mean, what's it meant to be, an alternative United Nations?
Well, there's a couple of things. You point out there's no one from Palestine there, which is obviously an issue. But there are rings of colonialism with Western powers determining the future of Gaza without their input anyway. But the further things, the remit, which appears to be much broader than Gaza, and give that board, remit to intervene or offer thought strategy for a whole range of other conflicts. That is what the UN's supposed to be doing. So, there's a lot of aspects that bore that are just not clear to general people, I think.
Martin, one day we'll get back to Western Australia and Fremantle and talk about local politics, but there's so much going on internationally. Is there anything we've sort of taken our eyes off that we need to put our eyes back on in the weeks that come? I suppose there's always something awful happening in parts of Africa, Sudan, and round about. What about in the rest of the world? We don't talk about Venezuela anymore.
No, there's a you make some important points here. A couple of things. Venezuela, it's still somewhat unresolved because you have the vice president that's working away. There's some reports that the vice president colluded with the Trump administration to see Maduro removed. I thought that was rather astonishing because they're all part of the one administration. So that was rather fascinating. But we are seeing some oil shipments coming from Venezuela controlled by the US, which does reaffirm that that's the key strategy behind that particular move. In other parts of the world, that some of those a lot of those conflicts are continuing. Gaza, we've seen a ceasefire. It is good that a lot less military activity is taking place in Gaza, but there are still people getting killed every day. There's still conflict there. So the sooner they can move to next steps, the better. They do actually need to do that because otherwise that situation at the moment is drifting. And I can't see that ending well unless they are taking next steps. The Sudanese civil war is continuing. That remains a very vexed issue. There are so many conflicts around the world, Michael. It would be good if they were resolved by some action-packed board, but I think a bit more investment in key committees and processes around the UN could be helpful there, because they are the body since the 40s, which has been, they are far from perfect. The UN, they've had their own issues, but using that mechanism more effectively might have been helpful too.
Well, I must say I'm still committed to the UN. The reasons which were advanced or made clear we needed a UN after the Second War, and people like Doc Evatt, the Australian Labor leader, had a lot to do with, seem to me to be as compelling today, if not more than ever. Which makes me wonder, in that sense, why Australia shouldn't become a neutral country, Martin. Is it a completely crazy idea, do you think?
I mean, the immediate challenge here is that we are very invested, and we've got US bases here, and we have a lot of joint exercises with the US. The other thing, Michael, is we've already spent several billion dollars on AUKUS. Those payments are already going forward. So there's a lot of existing resources poured into that relationship. The question emerges as to what a post-Trump environment would look like. Is he just a disruptor and things might go back to normal? I don't know. There's a lot of unknowns in international affairs at the moment.
Well, I suppose we used to say a week was a long time in politics. I think it's coming down to minutes, Martin. I have to check my news feed many times a day to see if that something else momentous has happened. How do you think things will look in just even the middle of this year, both nationally and internationally? There's a question of both hope and reality weighing in on the answer to that question.
Well, I think that the question we want to look at is the future of NATO and how well that holds up. I think it will in the end, Michael, just because it's in everyone's interests that it continue, but it's looking less certain than it used to. Here in national politics, all of a sudden the future of the coalition is really front and centre because a good opposition holds the government to account. We do actually need an opposition to hold the government to account. That's a healthy thing, and at the moment they're very fragmented. So I think that's going to occupy a fair bit of time and space. And then there's all the issues that were unresolved from the end of last year as well. So I think it's going to be a fairly, again, a fairly action-packed year.
And of course, we've got the midterms coming up in May in the US. That's going to be, I'm not sure how to describe it. I'll use the same word, momentous. We should learn a lot from that, Martin, one way or the other.
I think that the midterms will be really interesting in the US. That will be the litmus test for Trump really in his presidency and may well weaken him. I should say that's not going to happen until November, Michael. So got a little while to wait
Sorry, I
there.
jumped ahead. The midterms, not the mid-years. Interestingly, the New York Times opinion polls at the moment show that the Republican supporters are still pretty rusted on to Trump, and of course, the Democratic Party supporters hate him with a passion. Nothing looks to be dramatically changing, despite what we might think is bad press for Trump.
Yeah, I think getting people out in the midterms has traditionally been an issue. I think that what we focus a lot on international affairs, Michael, but I think the domestic economy and how that's hitting many people in the hip pocket might have a bigger say than we anticipate there in the midterms. And if people are finding it tough, they're going to blame Trump for that.
Well, Martin, I think it's probably time to go and have a nice swim at the beach. Watch the F-18 sailing around on Coburn Sound, and ignore what's going on in the rest of the world. But you've got a university run; you'd better get back to it.
Well, it's always a pleasure to have a chat and talk all things politics and international relations.
See you next week, Martin.
Take care.